welcome each and every one of you to this very special occasion. This is the Henry and Nancy Horton Bartels World Affairs Fellowship Lecture. My name is Fred Logevall, and I'm the director of the Mario Einaudi Center for International Studies here at Cornell and a faculty member in history. And I'm so honored and pleased to be here to say a few introductory remarks and to welcome as this year's Bartels World Affairs Fellow, Dr. Michelle Bachelet, Undersecretary General of the United Nations and Director of UN Women, and previously the President of Chile from 2006 to 2010. Since its founding in 1961, the Einaudi Center has helped to stimulate and coordinate Cornell's mission, its work in and about the world. The center plays an important role as a kind of hub for Cornell's international dimension. It plays an important role in producing at Cornell graduates who have cross-cultural awareness, who are the leaders of tomorrow and who have an understanding of the world around them. That's, I think, fundamentally what we see ourselves as doing. Along with the specialized programs it houses and supports, the center provides a forum for broad dialogue that cuts across disciplines here at the university, that serves to internationalize the university's research, teaching, and outreach agenda. And this fellowship, the Henry and Nancy Horton Bartels World Affairs Fellowship, is one of the signature entities that we have at the center. The purpose of the fellowship is to foster broader understanding of international affairs among Cornell students, faculty and staff, and also the broader Ithaca community. And in addition to giving a major public lecture, as today's fellow has learned, Bartels Fellows also interact with faculty, graduate students, and undergraduates in classes and in informal gatherings. These distinguished visitors share not only their views on major global issues, but also their own personal experiences in international public service. Hank and Nancy Bartels are unable to be with us tonight, but on behalf of Cornell University and certainly the Mario Einaudi Center, I thank the Bartels family for establishing this World Affairs Fellowship, which now dates back to 1984. We're coming up on 30 years, and which has provided our community with these stimulating and much-discussed visits by prominent international figures. I also want to extend another small thanks, which is to the Chilean Association at Cornell, or CHAZ for short, for their support in preparing this visit. The members of this Chilean group have worked very hard to help bring this day about. We're very grateful to them for their support, their enthusiasm, their work, and also for helping to promote this in the broader community. And I think the fact that we have such a superb turnout today is testimony to their efforts, among others. Dr. Bachelet will be introduced this afternoon by our provost, Kent Fox, who is a dear friend of the Einaudi Center and of International Studies here at Cornell. I ask you to join me now in welcoming Provost Fox.
Well, welcome everyone to one of the most eagerly anticipated events in the Cornell calendar, the annual Bartels World Affairs Fellowship Lecture. We're honored to present Dr. Michelle Bachelet, Undersecretary General of the UN Women and former President of Chile, as a 2012 Henry E. and Nancy Horton Bartels World Affairs Fellow. Cornell's Mario Einaudi Center for International Studies presents the Bartels Lecture every year. And thanks to the generosity of Hank and Nancy Bartels, many distinguished visitors have been here at Cornell in the role of the Bartels Fellow. These have included individuals such as Archbishop Desmond Tutu, His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama, also Louise Arbour, the former UN Commissioner for Human Rights. Since 1984, we've had some 30 speakers, all influential global leaders in world affairs, and we're delighted today that Dr. Bachelet has consented to join this stellar company. Michelle Bachelet has been breaking down barriers for much of her career, and through her current position with the United Nations, she is helping women around the world transcend the barriers to gender equity. She's the first head of the United Nations agency created 2 years ago, formerly called the Entity for Gender Equity and Empowerment of Women, or known informally as UN Women. It is the first major international agency focused on gender issues, and Dr. Bachelet brings to the position her distinguished record for advancing women's rights, among other accomplishments, in her native Chile. She's had an early introduction to the politics of Chile when she and her family suffered severely under the regime of Augusto Pinochet, and her medical studies were interrupted by detention and then exile in 1975. A few years later, she returned to Chile and completed her degree in pediatric medicine. With the departure of Pinochet in 1990, Dr. Bachelet became increasingly involved in politics. She was appointed Minister of Health in 2000, and in that role, she succeeded in improving the primary care system for families. In 2002, she became the nation's first woman Minister of Defense. In that role, she introduced policies to improve the conditions of women in the military and also in the police force. In 2006, she was elected president, and she became not only the first female president of Chile, but also the first in any South American country whose career was not founded on her husband's. Early in her presidency, Dr. Bachelet weathered a number of challenging domestic issues, but by the time her term ended in 2010, she was one of the most successful and popular presidents in the history of the country. Much of her success was due to a controversial decision that she made to save billions of dollars gained from copper sales during a commodity boom. When the global financial crisis struck in 2008, those invested funds allowed Chile not only to avoid the crisis, but to carry out initiatives, including the creation of free childcare, centers for low-income families, and guaranteed pensions for the poorest citizens, as well as low-income homemakers. Today, Dr. Bachelet brings to the UN what the Secretary General has described: her wealth of experience, her global leadership, and global stature. She has described her goal as making sure that women's issues are an essential element on the agenda of all heads of states and all governments worldwide. We are fortunate to have her here with us today to discuss women and the new development paradigm. Please join me in welcoming Michelle Bachelet.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, distinguished faculty, alumni, and students. Well, thank you very much. I'm really delighted to be here with you today at Cornell University on your beautiful Ithaca campus. And it's an honor, really, to deliver this year's Bartels World Affairs Lecture at an institution that I can say can uniquely claim equal opportunities for men and women in education as one of its founding principles. It is inspiring to think, as I address you here right now, on Jenny Spencer. As the first female matriculate of this university, she won a state scholarship and traversed this campus for the first time in 1870. She was literally taking a historic step forward as she entered what 2 years later would become the first major institution in the eastern United States of its kind, a co-educational university. But it's also inspiring to think of a woman like Mae Preston. She was awarded a PhD here at this prestigious institution in 1880. She was one of the few women of the United States granted the opportunity to pursue and receive a PhD prior to the 20th century, and it was in this university. And May was lucky to have progressive-minded parents who encouraged her to seek her own course and persevere towards her goals at a time when the aspirations of many young women were limited to finding a good husband. She was an early leader an advocate of the women's suffrage movement. She forged her own path and was instrumental in opening minds and opening doors that had traditionally withheld women from achieving personal and intellectual freedom. Jessie Spencer and Mae Preston were trailblazers, and they are joined by millions of women around the world who continue to take historic steps for equality in their own countries, cities, and villages. All over the world, women are moving forward, raising their voices, and claiming their rights as full citizens with equal rights and equal opportunities and participation. They're studying and getting an education, finding employment and enjoying their own income, and voting and, in some cases, running for office and getting elected so that they can participate in decision-making to help shape their societies and strengthen democracy. What is also interesting and noteworthy is that more and more men are joining us in the quest for women's empowerment and gender equality. Today, one of the most poignant and powerful examples comes from Senegal. Their village chiefs in more than 5,000 communities in Senegal are standing up alongside women, saying no to the traditional practice of female genital cutting and mutilation. Senegal may very well become the first high-prevalence country to succeed in ending this harmful centuries-old practice. And the beauty of this impending success, and probably the reason also of this success, by which girls will no longer fear being cut and having a part of their bodies and sexuality removed, is that it's not imposed from the outside, but comes from within the society between men and women. And that is the way it should be. Real equality requires trust and respect and cooperation between boys and girls and men and women. It requires open minds and open dialogue. And of course, it requires concrete changes through laws, policies, programs that can permit breakdown barriers and actually institutionalize equality. Of course, we know that it takes generations to bring about fundamental changes to achieve gender equality. But the progress of the past century and in the past few decades has been remarkable. And that is the journey that I want to talk about today. I want to talk about where we have been and where we are headed on the road to equality and how this journey not only demands open mind and open doors from all of us, but very importantly, it demands particular and specific decisions and policies. It demands special temporary measures to level the playing field and increase the proportion of women in decision-making positions. Today, the conversation is changing and evolving in exciting ways. It is a conversation that in this short time has expanded to become an intrinsic part of the global conversation on peace and security, on democracy, on economic development, or, as in RioPlus20, on sustainable development. And I'm honored to be part of this conversation during this time in history as the first executive director of this newest United Nations agency, UN Women. And I bring you greetings from my colleagues worldwide. We celebrated our first year of operations in January, and let me say this, the very creation of UN Women, and it's called, the long name is the Entity for Gender Equality and Women's Empowerment, by the United Nations General Assembly, illustrated a crucial, and I would say historic, recognition from the international community. The recognition, and it's been a long time coming, is that gender equality and women's empowerment are not only goals in their own right. Of course, they are goals in their own right. But they also are fundamental drivers of social, cultural, political, economic progress. Fundamental driver if we really want to achieve Millennium Development Goals, for example. Fundamental drivers if we are to achieve sustainable development. And this recognition that progress for women is progress for all informed the creation of UN Women. And today, even though we have a presence, physical presence, because we are a small agency in 75 countries, we do have a universal mandate to advance all over the world in gender equality and women's empowerment. And in just a year and a half, we have accomplished and been witness to progress in several key priority areas, from advancing women's political participation and leadership, to opening doors for women in the economy, to taking concrete steps to end violence against girls and women, to increasing women's participation in peace talks and peace building. We support public plans and budgets that benefits men and women and boys and girls equally and strengthens societies and economies. In many ways, the mandate of UN Women is a culmination of decades of efforts by women rights activists, NGOs, civil society groups, governments, and the UN system. And we are established to deliver on the promise in the founding charter of the United Nations to achieve equal rights for women and men all over the world. Since its founding nearly 68 years ago, the UN has been setting milestones to advance women's rights worldwide. From hosting four global women's conferences, the first in 1975 and the last in 1995, to raise the voices of women to set the global agenda for equality, to codifying women's human rights in an international treaty that constitutes a universal bill of rights for women, the UN has played a leadership role supporting the rights of women and men. During this century, the Security Council has adopted five resolutions on women, peace, and security, starting from the landmark resolution 1325 in October 2000. This resolution seeks to redress sexual violence during and after conflict, to bring perpetrators to justice through the International Criminal Court and tribunals, and to expand the number of women sitting at the peace talks and engaged in building peace agreements so peace is just, lasting, and sustainable. And we're making progress. The world looks very different for women now than it did a century or even a half century ago. In education, girls now outnumber boys in secondary schools in 45 developing countries, and two-thirds of all countries have achieved gender parity in primary education. Life expectancy for women has increased in developing countries by as many as 20 to 25 years. Gender equality is legally guaranteed in the constitutions of 173 countries. This is tremendous progress for a world where in 1911, women had the right to vote in only two countries. And there is rising awareness that we cannot solve the great challenges of our time unless we unleash the potential and full and equal participation of women. Whether we're talking about addressing climate change or reducing poverty and inequality, there is growing awareness that we need to tap into the collective intelligence and wisdom of the entire population. We need to advance equal rights, opportunities, and participation for all. In this quest, the power of education is palpable. Education is a stepping stone, and Cornell University is a powerful symbol of equality. I wonder what Ezra Cornell would say if he were still alive today about the fact that more women than men now attend universities worldwide. He would likely be pleased to know that women's university enrollment has risen more than sevenfold since 1970. That's an improvement even from the time of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, when she graduated from Cornell in 1954. Here at Cornell, and especially those of you here in the Feminist Gender and Sexuality Studies program, know that you are part of a long tradition of leading the conversation on gender equality of pioneering women's rights activists and feminist academics. You have open minds, but you have also opened doors. When you brought national attention to issues of sexual harassment and discrimination in the workplace, and when you founded one of the country's first women's studies programs four decades ago. So education is a driving force for equality. And today when I was having the chance to share lunch with a group of students and afterwards a colloquium with another group, I was mentioning that education is essential, and that, of course, is very clear. But it's not only sort of a principle. It's also very clear here in this region, in the Americas region. Studies made in 2008 and 2010 by the World Bank show that when you analyze all the different factors that a family can have to provide a child a future, for example, that a Guatemalan rural boy or girl could be in the future a lawyer or be sitting here in Cornell, the main factor, more than any other, is the level of education of the mother. The same thing happens with girls in Africa. As long as they stay, or not only in Africa, in many other parts of the world, the longer they stay at school, the better conditions they have, and of course, better conditions of life, better jobs, better salary, but also much lower levels of rates of early forced marriage, early pregnancy, rape, rates of living with HIV/AIDS, etc. And let me speak from my personal experience. It was my education in medicine, I'm a medical doctor, both in Chile and while in exile abroad, that enabled me to pursue a professional path as a pediatrician. And it led the way for me also because I decided to study, and that led me to be a minister of health, where I built on my experience to implement healthcare reform to benefit families. But also on this idea that if you know better the issues, if you can really understand what's going on, you can find the better policies. Is that I studied defense issues and security issues. And that's how I became Minister of Defense, to continue to reform the armed services sector towards more human rights and justice approach. It was also education that set in motion a career that would allow me to serve as a leader in my home country of Chile, and now, of course, in the United Nations at UN Women. I always say that people knew me as Minister of Health, but I was, as Minister of Health, a caregiver. When I became a Minister of Defense in a traditionally male-dominated field, is that people started looking at me as a possible President of the Republic. And I became Minister of Defense, being a politician, yes, but having the knowledge of the studies on defense and security that led me also, permitted me also, to develop a very good relation with the armed forces and discussion, very frank, but also informed discussions. But I have said there's a lot of progress, yes, because I always believe you have to acknowledge where you are. But on the same time, while many women like me are forging our own path, millions of others continue to face barriers that block them from reaching their own potential. Today, one woman dies every 2 minutes from complications of pregnancy and childbirth. And this is so linked that still today, 217 million young women and women lack of access to sexual and reproductive services, lack of access to contraceptives. And that's why there is a strong push and try to decrease at least to the half so we can advance on diminishing maternal mortality and providing women better conditions and of life. Violence against women remains a global epidemic. Women earn less than men for the same work and remain underrepresented in decision-making. Less than 1 in 10 head of states and government. Less than 1 in 5 members of parliament. And less than 4% of CEOs of Fortune 500 companies are women. And the main point that I would like to make today is that the historic and persistent marginalization and discrimination of women is not sustainable. This social exclusion of women is not only hurting women, it's hurting all of us. So for the sake of current and future generations, for the sake of the challenges we have to confront, we must nurture and develop all of humankind's collective intelligence and capacity. The full and equal participation and leadership of women is no longer an option. It's an urgent necessity if we are to achieve the transformational change needed at all levels and spheres of society for development that is really sustainable. Since 1992, global economic growth has soared 75%. So when we see the challenges of the world, it's not, not considering this last period of financial and economic crisis, but if you see from 1992, but even if you look at the economic evolution or, I would say, outcomes since the creation of the United Nations, the GDP, global GDP, has increased 7 times. But, however, what does it mean for humanity? At what cost has been this global economic growth? More than one in four people still lives in extreme poverty. Two-thirds of natural resources vital to humankind are declining. By 2030, the world will need 50% more food, 45% more energy, and 30% more water. And rising sea levels and climate change pose an unprecedented threat to humanity. So we really cannot afford to continue on the present path, on the present paradigm of inequality that poses so much threat to humanity. And of course, we cannot afford to leave women marginalized in leadership and decision-making as subject to violence and discrimination. When women enjoy equal rights, opportunities, and participation, they can make a greater contribution to sustainable development. My point is, women are victims of many abuses of human rights. True. And we see it in democratic countries, and we see it in conflict countries, and we see it also in post-conflict countries. And when Resolution 1325 spoke about how women can be part of the peace-building, peacemaking, we have worked a lot in terms of trying to avoid violence, to end impunity against gender-based violence, rape, but we still are so far away on ensuring that women can have a place as peacemaker, peace-builder, and on the other hand, that women's concerns and needs really are considered in the peace agreement. And the percentage of peace agreements that fail after 5 years is very important. And it's not only because women are not there, but it's also because women are not there. So I truly believe that women, of course, in any area you look at it, are disproportionately affected by poverty, by inequalities, by climate change, etc., food insecurity, energy crisis, etc. But on the other hand, I truly believe that women are big contributors, can be enormous agents of change, of peace and development. So we believe that the full and equal participation of women really can contribute to make societies, economies, and the environment healthier. There is data that shows that countries with greater gender equality have higher gross national product per capita, that women in the corporate sector results in improved business performance, and that more women in parliament tend to ensure more equitable laws and social programs and budgets that benefit all. So with all this in mind, when we have been defining our priorities, priority area for UN Women for this year, even though we have to work on all the different areas, priorities that bear tremendous consequences for development and will boost gender equality. And these are advancing women's economic empowerment, expanding women's political participation and leadership, and of course, ending violence against women and girls, but of course, advocating on education, migration, health, domestic work, etc., HIV/AIDS, any area you can imagine, we are working on that. But focusing also in those areas where we are the leading force and where we have the biggest gaps. Let me first address the matter of unleashing women's full economic potential and removing the barriers that stand in their way, whether they are social, cultural, or legal. Today, women in developing countries make 43% of agriculture work. But I have to say that this is the average, and it's all average, hides so many important characteristics. Because this is true because Latin America and the Asia-Pacific area, women are not important part of the agricultural labor force. But if you go to Africa, for example, there are countries where it's even 80%. And it's very important because they all usually own only 2% of the land. So it's a very uneven situation. But usually, if it would be 43%, they cannot get equal access to land credit of new technology. And of course, this is not sustainable. The Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, estimates that giving women the same access to men as men, not more, the same, to fertilizer, seeds, tools, and other types of agricultural support would raise agriculture output and result in 100 to 150 million fewer hungry people. But we also have the huge problem of access to energy. And we know that in many parts of the world, one-third of the day, women and girls, and small girls many times, have to dedicate it to get to collect firewood or fetch water. So energy is an essential issue, but it's also a global health issue, because today millions of mostly rural women will cook over smoky, polluting stoves. And as a result, 2 million people die each year from respiratory ailments, and 85% are women and children. And this is not sustainable. Women need clean energy, and there are solutions there. Today in urban areas, a quarter of people lack piped water in their homes. This places a disproportionate burden on women and girls who spend long hours each day, as I mentioned before, but not only in the rural area, also in the urban areas, fetching water for basic household needs instead of getting an education or earning an income. So advancing gender equality is essential to tackle all those concrete issues. But also advancing gender equality is essential for food security and also for economic growth that is inclusive and equitable. I have to mention where the women generate income. The dedicate study shows that they dedicate between 70 to 90% to food security, education, and health. Well, it is both the right thing and the smart thing to do. To ensure women's rights, to advance in gender equality and women's empowerment, especially during this time of rising inequality and up and down economies. So let me tell you something. It is the right thing to do. And that's, I would say, a sufficient reason to work as hard as possible to advance on gender equality and women's empowerment, on women's rights. But it's also the smart thing to do. And we have heard so long ago the world's smart economic. And in a time when economies are living so many difficult times, so many people are unemployed, studies show that closing the gap between male and female employment rate would boost GDP by 9% in this country, for example. And ending discrimination against women in certain sectors or occupation could increase labor productivity in some countries by as much as 25%. Yet, there's so many documents, so many information about the documented benefits, women continue to face barriers to fully participation in the economy. Women continue to earn less than men for the same work, 17% less on average, and face barriers in reaching the top and balancing work and family life. You have heard so many times hearing about the glass ceiling, but it's also about leaking pipeline. UN Women is working with countries to remove this barrier that limits women's economic participation, from providing training and skills to making laws, policies, and conditions fair for women. We're working with governments to support small business owners, with informal cross-border traders, with women workers at the market. I just came back from Australia and the Pacific Island, and the Australian Prime Minister, and we are partnering on that, in form of a new program, Australian Program for the Pacific Islands, that is the place of the world where women are in the most unequal conditions in terms of political participation, economic participation, and the highest rates of violence against women. They have decided $300 million for a 10-year program that is also very new and important, because changes on this kind of issues are not changes that can happen in 2-year or 3-year program. It takes longer. So we are going to work together on supporting those women in terms of political participation, economic empowerment, but also ending violence against women. So I said that we're working with governments to support small business owners with us cross-border markets, but also to secure the rights of domestic workers. We work very strongly for the adoption of the ILO Convention on Domestic Workers. It's incredible, 2011, first time in history that domestic work is considered, through this convention, a work. Before, it was not considered a work, so it did not have the regulations that that all women deserve, or men who work in domestic work deserve. So we also support women, as I said, in the marketplace. It's not only about women as workers, as producers, as farmers, as traders. It's in the whole supply chain, but also women's in the companies. And we are reaching out to the private sector by promoting the women's empowerment principles. So far, more than 400 CEOs have committed to the principles, and programs are underway in companies to recruit and retain more female managers. And I want to commend the Cornell University for the ADVANCE project that intends to bring more women, and particularly to particular areas like science, technology, etc. But we're working, as I said, with the private sector to recruit and retain more female managers. And for that, it's essential to find out all, not only the glass ceiling, but all the leaking pipeline and all the bias that are making women leave the companies or not permitting them to be in the places they should be. We're working with them to set targets for women's presence on corporate board. And I have to say, the first country who started with this is Norway. After they started voluntary, it did not work. They defined 40% of the board should be female, and they make it mandatory. After 6 years, it has been impressive, because it's not only about having women everywhere. It's about what women can bring to it, how can they contribute, and the performance of those companies has improved very importantly. And also enhancing training for women and advancing flexible working arrangement for working parents. As a young mother and a pediatrician, I myself experienced the struggles of balancing family and career. I saw how, for example, I mean, I could do it. I could pay for a private childcare facility for my children while I was studying, afterwards working. But for instance, what it meant for so many women, the absence of childcare prevented women from paid employment. And I think the provost mentioned that one of my programs was Chile Crece Contigo. That was Chile, he would say, grows with you. It was a symbol of a country growing, of course, healthy, and children growing healthy. And it was linked to the perception that only 38%, the female rate in labor participation was only 38%. And after this program, it's increased in 4 years, 5 years to 42%. So how important it is when you want to advance on women's opportunities rights is to really think on all the specific policies needed to really, I would say, to acknowledge what the obstacles, the barriers, and find the solutions for it. Many of this, even of my own experience, it's one of the reasons, but the main reason is that I just could not accept social injustice or injustice at all. I just could not bear with it. So that's what drove me to politics, to try to change the world for the better. It was what drove me to political office, and as I said, what's one of the main reasons why I also thought that in supporting policies to increase the availability of childcare and a whole social protection program for families. But let me now turn to my second priority, and doesn't mean that it's less important. I'm just trying to put it in certain order. Because economic empowerment for women to deal with all this complexity, with all the, I was talking today that the one study this year of the World Bank showing more than 140 countries, the incredible amount of disparity and inequalities in laws for women and men, and particularly if they're married, to have access to economic tools to be able to sign a contract, etc. So if we really want to achieve economic empowerment, it's impossible to achieve it without women in positions of leadership. And this is a challenge for both developed and developing countries. Take a look around. I'm not meaning this auditorium. Women are lacking in the boardrooms, representing about 13% of board members in the US, 11% in Canada. A mere 3% of Fortune 500 CEOs are women, as I mentioned. And we cannot further gender equality or women's empowerment through economic advances alone. Real changes in policies and legal frameworks depend upon women's civic and political engagement. The lack of women in parliaments, in judiciaries, in the budget committees, hinders the progress of policymaking and the creation of law that address the shortcomings that are putting women at a disadvantage in our society. Everywhere I go, I call for more women leaders. Today, less than 1 in 10 presidents and prime ministers. I mean, the UN has 195 member states. We have right now, I believe, because it changed a little bit, 19 prime ministers and president. Well, Latin America is a curiosity, if I may say. Good news, if I may say. Because now we have three presidents, Argentina, Brazil, and Costa Rica, and two prime ministers, Jamaica and Trinidad and Tobago. So I hope we lead by example the rest of them. The rest of the Americas first, and then the rest of the world. I didn't intend to say that women in the region don't have problems. I just said that it was interesting. Well, but less than one in five members of parliaments are women. Really, it's 19.5%. We work with the International Parliamentarian Union. We measure every year how it's increasing. It's increased very slowly. And Beijing, in 1995, established in the action plan a goal that it was to achieve 30% of female representation in parliament as the critical minimum mass to really ensure that policies, that laws, will really represent women and men's need. And this 30% critical mass mark for women's representation in parliament has been reached or exceeded in only 33 countries. There has been some progress. Probably we have seen in the 3 decades since the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, CEDAW, came into effect. CEDAW has spurred the movements toward gender equality in many of the 187 countries that are signatories to it, but the fundamental inequality in political participation remains a glaring reality. Don't hate me, but the United States have not ratified the CEDAW Convention, I have to say. It's just a fact. Women leaders not only influence politics, they provide an example to their peers, to the public, and to the younger generation. Their success is proof for young people, boys and girls alike, of the importance of education, but also of the importance of civic engagement. Without them, we cannot experience fully functioning democracy, where the issues that matter most to all groups in society are represented and recognized. And this is the case for women, where basic but crucial rights, such as protection from sexual discrimination and violence, equal access to education and economic opportunities, or equal rights to land and inheritance, are persistent subjects of neglect. In particular, the right of women to take charge of their own sexual and reproductive health and or sexual and reproductive rights remains far from secure. And it is doubtful we will hear such a rhetoric as we do if this continuous debate on women's bodies, if there were adequate representation of women in politics, even here in the United States. I really find incredible that men have to decide on women's bodies. So that the right of women to decide if, when, or how many children she wants to have is still up for debate is a sign of the work that still lies ahead of all of us. So is the fact that some people still to think that some rapes are less terrible than others. One very effective way to bring more women into positions of leadership is through temporary special measures, such as quota, but also there's not only quotas. There in Tunisia, for example, the first democratic election beginning this year, they did not include quota, they include the parity law. It's called parity and zipper law. It means that every list has to have 50% of female and male candidates, otherwise they cannot register the list, they cannot inscribe, but also that men and women have to go one man, one woman, or one woman, one man, etc. And, in the case of Tunisia, there was so much enthusiasm that there was more than 100 parties. So it was very difficult for men or women to be elected, really. But having said that, it got 26% of female representation. Pretty good for a country that for the first time voted democratically. And the same happened now in Libya that had... they introduced this for a percentage. They elected 80 people and 120 people, and in two different systems. But in the system of 80, that was a list of parties, they included the paritarian law. And then it was like 15%. I mean, for a country who really did not have a democratic experience, because I was there, we were preparing women, incentivizing them to go to vote, but also supporting women who wanted to run for candidate. It was really an incredible experience in a society where there was not such a thing as experience on civil society organization, political parties, etc. So those transitional special measures, and we call it that way because the day that gender equality is not an issue, we will need this kind of affirmative action. But if we really want to advance, we need to advance producing, if I would say, to level the playground. Otherwise, it's very difficult for women to be considered as candidate and to be elected. Experience has shown that the inclusion of women in politics, because somebody could ask, okay, but why do you insist on women in politics? And in Libya, we were discussing this issue. It's not having women everywhere because we are women and we want to be everywhere. Well, that's true too, but that's not the main reason that I can confess here publicly, no. When I established this, I shouldn't say this, because typical when you say this, this is the only thing that somebody remembers of the lecture. But when I decided there will be a paritarian cabinet, and not only cabinet, through all the government, it was because I really believe that in every country we have wonderful men and wonderful women. But usually women, because of all what we have been talking about, are invisible. And one of the main issues to start with the government was to make a strong message that we cannot and will not lose all the potential of these women. So I started with a gender paritarian cabinet. But of course, in the meetings, I will joke is that I love to dance, so that was the only way we all could dance. But that's not true. The real reason is because we really believe that it's so important to give the opportunities of capable women and men to develop the policies and the political experience. But going back, it has been shown, as in the economy, more women in the economy in different positions, but of course in high-level position in boards, produces better economic performance. Having more women in politics has also beneficial effects. The inclusion of women in politics has had a great effect on legislations and programs directly addressing issues of women's rights and gender equality, as well as on the amending of constitutions. There has been some truly groundbreaking results in countries such as Rwanda, Sweden, South Africa, Nicaragua, Timor-Leste, and most recently in Algeria, where all of them are over 30%. Well, Rwanda is 56% of female representation. South Africa is 44%. Nepal, today I met a girl from Nepal, it has 34% of female representation, the highest in the Asia-Pacific area. Well, quotas are very effective. I already mentioned that of the 33 countries with 30 or more women, 26 had quotas or in place. And of course, these others have also had this gender parity law. But the most important thing, so we know that quota helped ensure positive outcomes. But women's equal representation, of course, is a matter of justice and a matter of democracy. Women constitute, in every country may change a little bit, but around more than 50% of the world's population. So we're talking about 3.5 billion women in the world. But as we mentioned, they are underrepresented in the allegedly representative bodies that make key decisions affecting their life. Currently, women average 19.5% of parliamentarians. It is a matter of straightforward justice, but it's also a matter of improving the democratic quality of representation. By having more women as legislators, more concerns, different concerns, will be brought to the public arena to respond to the diverse needs and concerns of the society. Having more women in politics have also a positive effect in terms of creating positive role models for young women and girls and boys. Let me share with you a 2007 MIT study in India found that the increased presence and visibility of female politicians in local governments raised the academia performance of and career aspiration of young women and also changed for the better the attitudes and expectations of boys and parents. In villages that had never had female political leaders, researchers found parents were 45 less likely to expect their daughters to continue beyond secondary school. But worse than that, the girls themselves were 32% less likely to have those aspirations. So the role model effect of women leaders is really important because it paves the way for future generations. And I cannot not share with you something that may, if you already heard me, please forgive me for sharing again, is when I realized that because I was a minister of defense, I came into the collective imagination of my people as a possible president. I always remember the story that once Tarja Halonen told me, the Finnish president, when she said to me she ended this year in January or February, a 12-year term as president of Finland. And when she was already in office, like 8 years or 9 years, she visited a kindergarten where there were children of 5, 4, 6 years old. So she was asking all the children what they wanted to do when they were growing up. And they will answer the typical answers, you know, firefighter, doctor, lawyers, economist. I don't know if somebody said a politician. Soldiers, nurses, artists, dancers, whatever you can imagine. So there was a little boy, very silently, she came there and she said, "Don't you want to be president of Finland?" And he very seriously answered, "In this country, men cannot be president of the republic." It looks funny, but it's so important. That's why we need so much role models. That's why we need visible women. Because you don't need to speak, you don't need to hear somebody like me speaking all of this, because it will be a natural thing to understand, to believe, and even think that something else is impossible. That's why it's so really important to support women who really are courageous enough to try to run for office or to run to different decision-making positions. Because I think that we can do many things, all kinds of laws, but you know, policies, they don't implement it, nothing happens. All kinds of ideas, of created ideas, but images, symbolic representation, and real presence in powerful position is so important for women to advance, and the world to advance in a more, I would say, sustainable, just, and fair world for all. But of course, we cannot speak of gender equality without addressing the urgent need to eradicate violence against women. And when we're talking about violence, we're talking about all the whole range of violence, from domestic violence that we all know, gender-based violence, rape, but also human trafficking, early forced marriage, early forced pregnancy, female genital mutilation, etc., honor crimes, etc. The persistence of violence against women is staggering. 1 in 3 women will experience domestic or sexual violence in her lifetime. And such egregious human rights violation must be stopped now. Violence against women is not only a human rights abuse, it is indeed. But it also impedes progress towards development goals and reinforces structures of inequality. Studies show that countries with strong laws have lower rate of violence against women, but I should say, really, strong laws that are being implemented. And that means through the police forces, the judicial resources, providing promotion of rights, protection, prevention, protection, and provision of services. Because today, more than 125 countries have specific laws that penalized domestic violence. And if you think on a decade ago, it is a remarkable gain. But when you think on the country who are left, we're talking about 600 million women who live in countries where violence is accepted legally. This is why we need more women in leadership positions who will ensure that governments not only support laws, but also ensure their implementation, fulfill their obligation to provide adequate protections and resources to both halves of the population. More and more women and men and young people are standing up together and saying no to violence against women and girls. I just share with you that I just returned from Australia and that Pacific Island. I want also to share an example from the ground. Throughout Fiji, villages have committed to a zero-tolerance campaign. Village committees are reporting violators to the police and spreading the message that there will be no impunity for perpetrators of violence or abuse against women. Last year, 15 communities in Fiji joined the campaign, and this year, 50 more will join. And already we have heard reports that men's behavior is changing in response to this community action. Around the world, communities are pledging similar policies to provide justice and vital services to survivors of gender-based violence and to prevent and end violence against women and girls. If we are serious about tackling today's challenges, we must turn to the resource of women's knowledge and experience. We have watched in recent years women leaders come before as president, executives, or revolutionaries. Thanks to advances in technology and the rise of social media, women are able to exchange information, express their opinions, and contribute to public discussions like never before. The internet is bringing a new dimension to movements for change and democracy, one that is not subject to the traditional pitfalls, exclusion, and gender discrimination. And we have seen its effect, independently of what has happened afterwards, but at least some of the effects. Because the whole world bore witness to the participation of women in the Arab Spring uprising. I think the evolution has been very uneven, but still women were there, present, were an important part of those processes. And of course, we need to continue supporting their efforts to advance on women's rights. A precedent was set for these new governments and for the future of their democracies. And women will no longer stand on the sidelines, nor can we. Now it is time to stand up now for a sustainable future that means progress for all, a future that will be shaped by women and men as equal partners in solving the most pressing challenges of our time, whether to combat climate change, whether to tackle poverty, whether to push for human rights and to push for social justice, whether to find responses to the food insecurity or the energy crisis, whether to bring about peace or foster economic growth and development. So we need all of us to be participating very actively in trying to be a part of this future that needs to be shaped. So I thank you so much for the wonderful opportunity to speak with you today. I thank you for your scholarship and academic discourse and contributions to society. I thank you because I hope after, when your time comes, you will be the very important part of your life to help be a part of the solution of today's world challenge. And I urge you to continue to stand up for equality and progress for all. All of us at UN Women look forward to working with you so that the future women want is the future that we all share. Thank you very much.
Dr. Bachelet has agreed to take a few questions from the audience. We have a reception at 6 o'clock, so we have about 20 minutes. There are microphones here. Thank you. There are microphones here in the front, and if you want to just queue up for the Q&A, and if I can see you, I'll call on you. So we'll just go ahead and start. Yes, over here.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Bachelet.
There's also a microphone on this side, too.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Bachelet. That was very inspirational presentation. And I'm very glad, specifically as a researcher on Muslim and Arab women, that you mentioned specifically the issue of Tunisian representation. Because I would really like you to address the issue of relationship between civil representation and religious mandate. And let me give you an example why I'm asking this question. I would like you to say, how can we balance the real democratic aspiration, not the democracy that has been imposed by war, like the sad case in Afghanistan, where the US now is negotiating with the Taliban, who have the worst interpretation of Islam and the worst treatment of women, or in Iraq, where the new constitution really brought the Iraqi women back 50 years. So now, given the new so-called Arab Spring, these revolutionary movements, specifically in Tunisia, are leaning toward the conservative religious interpretation. So how are we going to balance the so-called civil parliamentary representation with those religious dogmas? Thank you.
Thank you.
I cannot give you the answer because I don't believe there is a recipe to this, to a process, to a political process. As I mentioned, during the Arab Spring, women could play a role, a significant role, and did play a significant role in Egypt, in Tunis.
They are pushed aside, excuse me. Now they are pushed aside.
No, so I know everything. I've been many times last year and this year. Don't worry, but I think we have to separate issues. One thing is the acknowledgement that in Tunisia, 26% of women were elected. Having said that, I didn't mention it before, but I did mention in the lunch meeting and in the colloquium, it's not only about having women in political places. It's about having women, and hopefully men, who are gender sensitive and who believe in gender equality and women's empowerment. Because I know women who are not gender sensitive at all. And not in the Arab countries, I have to say, and many other countries. So women usually who are in politics believe that if they are concerned about gender equality issues, they will be seen as weak, or that women's issues are soft issues. And in other countries, it's because of other reasons, ideological, religious, because it's not only about religion. You hear all kinds of discussions on women's rights or intents to constrain women's rights without a religious background, with the other kind of background. So I will tell you, I think that it was important there. I mean, I will believe it. I could tell it from my experience. I believe that always democracy is better than a dictatorship. Always a democracy is better. But democracy is not a result. It's a process. And it's democracy when you get rid of dictators and you establish a new, it can be a good democracy or a very weak democracy. I truly believe, and you cannot put every country in the same box, but what I believe, and that's our approach to the Arab region, and I cannot say much more because I'm not a person here, I'm a UN person. I have to continue working with everybody, and not only with the ones who are convinced, on the contrary, I need to work with the ones who don't believe that this is an important issue. But I truly believe, and I mentioned the Senegal experience and the Fiji experience, because it's not about imposing codes. It's not about imposing recipes. It's about ownership, real ownership. So if you ask me, like Michelle Bachelet, I would say the only possible thing is to continue working, supporting civil society organizations, women's organizations, human rights organizations. People has to, I don't believe that everybody has to be involved in political parties. I've been in political parties all my life, but I believe that social movements can play a substantive role, not necessarily being militants of a party. So but they have to work together. They have to make, if I may say, important fronts so they can really, I mean, we can have the truth by our side. We can have the reason. I don't know if that's the right word to say in English. In Spanish, es la razón. We can be the right ones, but we can be defeated. So you need to build the strength, the force to change things. It will take time, but we are going to be there to support and accompany that process.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take a question on this side. So, question from my left.
Oh, sorry, may I add something? But I'm really concerned on Afghanistan. Because when the troops leave, we need to ensure that all the progress made is not finished. So I think this is the time for governments. Because after the troops leave, it will come all the civil and economic support. And then governments need to explain clearly to the authorities that women's rights are not negotiated.
Question here.
Thank you, Dr. Bachelet, for coming to speak with us today. Your speech and your life are very inspiring. So thank you. My name is Tim Shank. I coordinate the Committee on U.S.-Latin American Relations here housed on campus. And in a week, we will be commemorating the 39th anniversary of the Chilean September 11, and the first of many experiments of a political and economic model called neoliberal capitalism. This model is not working for the large majority of the world's population, and it's most of all not working for women. According to UN data, women do 2/3 of the work in the world while only receiving 10% of the world's income. I know you know this. And own, as you said, 2% of the property in the world. You rightly said, we can't afford to continue on the current path of inequality. So my question is, how does the new development paradigm represent a clear alternative to the current economic model that produces more and more inequality, especially for women?
Well, the thing is that there's no such a thing as a new paradigm in place. When we say new paradigm, is we believe we need to develop a new paradigm. Because the present paradigm is producing all the inequalities, not only for women, but for women and men, for youth particularly, in a very important way. But I think, if I may say, very honestly, we have an intellectual and political challenge here. I have read and read and read and read trying to find, because I know what's wrong. I know what I don't like. I know what I want to change. But I haven't seen till now a clear and comprehensive, if I may say, from the economical and the political and international and all these aspects, approach that can tell us exactly what. We know a lot of things. We discuss in Rio Plus 20 how we want this sustainable world, not only in terms of climate change, on social, political environment that could bring equality to people. So we know sort of the principles what we want to achieve. An equal world for men and women, but not only in terms of rights in abstract, but in terms of opportunities, clear possibilities, and really be able to live a life that everyone deserves. I think we need to continue working much more on what is exactly that model, that paradigm. I don't have the answer, but I'm really working and studying a lot. I've been talking to very bright people, trying to know. And I talked to many of my friends that have been politicians in Europe, in U.S., many economists, trying to find what is this model, how will be this model that could really combine all these aspects in a way that really will be the better for whole humanity. And I don't have the full model yet. I have some parts, but I'll continue working on that. But I agree with you. This is not the world I want to live. I don't want this world for my children or my grandchildren. There's a lot of fantastic things, but there's so many people that are lagging behind.
Thank you. Question on the right.
Thank you so much, Doctor. This has been very wonderful. My name is Marcy Schaefer. I'm on a local board for Educate the Children, which also helps many women. And it's in Nepal. Villages have to write a letter to us to ask us to come to their village. It's a 5-year partnership where we take and help them build up the schools, put in another bathroom in so the girls keep going to school. And we have school gardens. We teach the women not only just agricultural, but literacy and fiscal literacy. They then incorporate, and then they then take their goods to market. And this is the first time they've owned anything. My husband, Dr. Sisler, was on that board for many years. He's a Cornell professor. What I'm wondering is, these wonderful things that we do, we've been donating for 20 years, and we have 2 girls, so we help 2 girls go through. We're having a hard time finding funding. So does the UN help some of these things that we've had independent surveyors come in and go to these villages, because we've only been there for 5 years, it's been going on for 25, and these independent surveyors have seen that the villages keep these things up, and these women, every woman that joins this is allowed to send a daughter to school, which doesn't happen there, and these villages have done so much better, but we're having a hard time finding funding.
Welcome to the club, I should say. two things. First, you mentioned so important thing, bathroom for so girls can continue going to school. And last year we were in this workshop on infrastructure and gender. And working with my colleagues that work in logistic, infrastructure, etc., and I told them, include the gender perspective, they will tell me, gender and infrastructure? What does anything have to do with highways, bridges, and so on? And everything has a gender perspective, because many people do not send girls to school because there are no separate school bathroom for girls and boys. Or you can build a bridge here or a highway there that can permit those women in those villages have access to markets or not, depending on how you define the way. So everything. But I have to tell you, it's not natural for people. They don't have it. So I wanted to mention that. To congratulate you for the beautiful work, we as the UN have to work on different levels. We need to make this sustainable. Somebody tells me, when you will consider the UN women succeeded? I would say the day that UN women doesn't need to exist anymore, because everyone is doing what they have to do. Governments are doing what they have to do. Civil society are doing what they want to do and have the possibilities as you to do it, etc. But the UN, the evolution on the development cooperation has changed dramatically over the years. And in terms of funding, I would say the UN today responds to approximately 30% of the funding in cooperation. It has another issues that are important. For example, it has the UN a convening force. And in the London summit with Melinda Gates Foundation and the UK and UNFPA and UN Women on trying to ensure contraceptive for women, you convene a lot of different sectors, and we work with the philanthropic work sector and so on. But the UN is living with the same problem of fundings because of the financial crisis, et cetera, et cetera. But having said that, there are in every different agency of the UN, there are programs, there are funds In UN Women will not be the benefits on education because UNESCO is in charge of education. We do have two funds, one trust fund for gender equality that is mainly for women's political participation and women's economic empowerment, but it's projects that the people present or directly, the grassroots organization or through NGOs. And the other one is the trust fund of the UN that we manage for ending violence against women. But there are UNDP, UNICEF, there are so many other agencies. You just can get into the webpage of the UN, and if you're lucky, you can get some money. But I have to tell you, the funding is a global problem. So it is a very complicated problem, because on one hand, every time we have a military conflict, it's so costly. And every time we discuss on development, it's so difficult to get money, not understanding. And I had to say, I've been a Minister of Defense, but I had to say, much of the violence of the conflict could have been prevented if we have solved in a better way the development challenges. So it's an investment, even if we're thinking on peace, if we're really working on development. But unfortunately, the world functions the other way. I mean, there is a conflict, we weren't able to prevent it, then we have to put money, helicopters, soldiers, etc., and afterwards, a little bit for development. And I think this is a wrong approach in the world. Of course, we need to try to avoid or prevent death and try to solve and bring peace. But I have to say, when you see that so high level of peace agreement fail 5 years later, it means that we haven't solved the structural problems. And many of them are linked to poverty and lack of development. And so I think that we need to do much more on development, not only the UN, because I'm not saying that we're going to avoid all conflicts, but I think we're going to prevent lots of them. So we need to continue looking. I would say, because I'm a historical optimistic person, the crisis won't last forever. So it will get better anyway.
So I have bad news, and that is that at 6 o'clock in 5 minutes,
we're going to end.
But I'm going to do the following. We're going to have four questions in parallel, and we're going to ask Dr. Bachelet to answer them as she wants. So two questions here. You have to be really brief, and then we'll turn it to her to answer them, okay? Can you be really brief with your question?
Yes.
Okay, really brief. Number one, go ahead.
Dr. Bachelet, it is an absolute honor to have you here and to have the opportunity to meet you. I think it's great that you went through the trouble to actually come up here to Cornell. My name is Antonio José Enriquez García, and I was born and raised in Venezuela, and I am now currently a student here at Cornell and president and co-founder of La Visión Latinoamericana, which is a student organization that concerns itself with the social, political, and cultural realities of the countries of Latin America. My question is very simple. Do you believe that the reforms that should be implemented in Chile with regards to the issue of gender inequality should be the same as the reforms that should be implemented in the rest of Latin American countries, mainly due to the cultural ties that exist between all of Latin American countries, from Mexico all the way down to Chile and Argentina?
Okay, thank you. Next question. This is a quiz for us to see if we remember.
Yes, my name is Myra Coveri. I'm a Cornell alum and a woman with a disability. And I'm speaking next week at the United Nations at the Conference of States Parties as an expert on women with disabilities. And I am thrilled to have, I want to say thank you to Dr. Bachelet and to Cornell University for the honor to participate in this event today. My question is, as women and men age, we're all likely to become men and women with disabilities. As women age, well, if we want to include all women, we must include women with disabilities. So my question is, what is UN Women doing, and what will you do in the future to include us in your work and in the progress that you are stimulating and making all over the world? Thank you.
Thank you. Good questions. Two over here, and then we'll...
Hello, my name is Hira, and first off, you look beautiful in the shalwar kameez. That's the national dress of my country. I come from Pakistan. I'm a public affairs fellow here, and my question is very simple. And I'm asking this on behalf of all the young women studying in Cornell. So what was more challenging for you, being a head of state or being the head of UN Women? And how did you achieve the work-life balance while assuming both the important roles.
Sorry, the second question,
How did you achieve work-life balance while, you know, on in these
work-life values for you? Yeah. Yes. Okay, last question.
I'd like to thank you for addressing equal access to education in your talk today. You've assiduously quoted statistics and evidence throughout your talk, but as we know, statistics don't always tell the whole story. With that in mind, I wanted to ask your opinion of the demands of student protesters in your native Chile for educación gratuita, pública y de buena calidad, a free public and high-quality education. What is, in your opinion, not only the future of access to education, but the well-being and quality of the institution under the current neoliberal development paradigm in which education is reduced to another bien de consumo in a global economy?
Okay, so Dr. Bachelet, we have four questions.
Yeah, I'll try to answer, and I don't think I could get into details in all of them, but, I would say you were asking, does gender equality need the same policies and laws in every country? I mean, you ask about Latin America, but this can be used in any other country in the world. I would say, as always, you need to have a baseline. I mean, which are the problems in each country in terms of gender rights? Which are the legislations in place that need to be changed? Which are the reforms that has to be introduced? And which are the policies that include laws, but also includes developing skills that can be introduced. I would have to say that there are many issues that are just the same. It's not many difference from one country to another. The Latin America culture is very similar. I mean, Chile was not a non-sexist country when I became president. I mean, and I had to deal with a lot of bias, prejudices, etc. But because I had the privilege and the honor to be the president of the republic, I also, if I may say, in that position, fought very hard to improve women's condition. But I would say it may have different characteristics because, for example, in Venezuela, you have many women, Minister of Foreign Affairs, so you have had women in very important positions. So every country has to make a diagnosis of its own situation and which are the essential issues. But I have to say, political participation, economic empowerment, ending violence against women, improving access to health, access to education, permitting women to unleash all their potential, I mean, those are universal. And it doesn't matter if it's a country who is a little bit more advanced than another. It's like social protection. I've been promoting social protection floor everywhere because I do believe that a more just world needs that we take care of the most needed ones. But of course, when we're talking of a floor, it speaks to us that you don't start from you don't have the same starting point or the ending point. So you need to establish your baseline and you need to define which will be your goals. Second, you need to prioritize and define what are the most urgent things, what are the most relevant things, and what are the more important things that really will mean not only like a makeup, but a real change and a real reform. But I have to say, in Latin America in particular, we have head of state, of government. We have better average of female representation in parliament than in other parts of the world. Not Chile, but the region. No, because in Chile, parliamentarians will not accept and approve a quota law. It's there in the freezer, if I may say, it's sleeping in parliament. I sent the law, but it's sleeping. It did not pass. So because presidents don't do what they want, you know, it's in a democracy. You try to do the most, but if there is parliament, bodies, etc. But you have heard, I think, about that. So I would say the main reforms, it can take different gradualities, but the main issues are the same issues elsewhere. In terms of women with disabilities, yes, we in the past we did not work at all in women and disabilities because it was not one of the areas. There are many areas where UNIFEM in the past, the main area of UN Women, did not work. We did not have any work on aging women. We didn't have any work on widows. And the first time that a group of women spoke to me about the importance of working on widow, I thought, oh, social security systems reform, because in my country I did the social security that benefit a lot of women. And of course there were some widows, there were women who were aged women who were widowed, but we were also talking about the huge amount of women in many countries of Asia and Africa who were widows or because of conflict or because their partners died because of HIV, because of AIDS. And they were young women with children and with no rights, with no inheritance rights, with no land rights. So there are a lot of areas that now we are trying to be involved in. We are participating. I have meetings with the main organization of people living with disabilities, and we are going to we are developing some projects and some programs to support men, and in this case, women living with disabilities. The more challenging things, I think, the more challenging thing for a man or a woman is to know exactly when you're in a certain position, what is the situation, what needs to be done, and what can be done. And the second is to be able to build the biggest possible consensus and agreement to push on that direction. Because that is about governing. It's trying to bring people together to agree on a certain thing. Because, and I'll link it to the other question of the students in the education movement. Chile has a paradoxical situation. It's not the paradise. She mentioned that statistics can hide. I think I didn't speak about Chile really because I am in my capacity of UN Women. I only use it as my personal experience. I would say that if you think that of every 10 students in tertiary education, 7 are the first generation in their families, we're talking about an important advance in terms of social mobility. So I would say Chile has advanced a lot in terms of access. I mean, complete coverage practically, because there's always 98% in primary education, probably 96% in secondary education, and 96% because in the rural areas, some boys drop out of school, prefer to go working in the rural and the field with the parents, even though we incorporate a lot of subsidy stimulus to children so they can go back to school, so they can be more interesting for those young people, et cetera. And tertiary education, as I mentioned, it was an expansion never seen in our country. So the challenge in Chile, but it's also, if I may say, a success of its own the process, is that quantity was not enough anymore. It's important not only access, but access to quality education for all. Because excellence, when you're talking about equality, is not only about coverage and access, it's about excellence. Because otherwise you're reproducing the unequal model. So that's the big challenge. But it's not only about, and so it means to define a system that will really work for everyone and not only for the ones who can pay, but it's not only at the university. Because if you stay, you have to deal, it's not only about more money, because you have to deal with inequalities that are not only social and economic. We have a very long country, and you have schools everywhere, and you have little schools, rural schools, when you have a teacher for 8 kids, and one can be in first grade, the other in second, so the teacher has to teach 7 children in a mountain over there, where fathers don't want to bring them to a bigger school because they want to have them at home, that 4 years, 5, 6, 7 years old. So one of the questions that, and I have the same problem as Minister of Health, how do I bring doctors in that incredible geography, difficult geography, with so little incentives for doctors? And it's not only about money. It's also about if the doctor is married, where the woman is going to work. to what school were they going to go to teach. So it's not only about putting more money in the economy, in the education. That is one essential thing, and it has to be done. But it's not enough. Because if you don't solve the problem of excellence of, if I may say, of the offer that you have of the teachers, of the quality of the schools, except of the possibility of having access to internet or not, what my children have had at my home, and I'm a middle-class woman, I'm not a rich woman, I'm very proud of a middle class, is that they always have saw their parents reading, discussing, analyzing, so there was a rich environment. Second, they have access to internet when it existed. In my time, it didn't exist, and even though I got to the presidents of the republic. So internet is important, but it's not the main issue. But now it's important because it brings a whole world. So when we brought internet, not in my government, before me, to the Mapuchean areas, those kids in the Mapuche area, they could have access to information they would have never had in all schools of Chile they had. So it's true what you said, but it's, unfortunately, there's no a silver bullet. It needs more money, and completely. We need a tax reform, and I read today that there has been an agreement between government and Senate, and that's fantastic. But I have to say, because I don't, not the kind of person who likes to tell me pirate stories and believe it. It's not only about money. It's also about how you ensure that rural areas and very dispersed and remote areas, how you ensure excellence there. It's a very difficult challenge to any person in charge of a region or of a village or whatever, because it's very difficult when you have a very long country. Having said that, I'm not saying it's impossible. It needs to be done. And I think we have a great opportunity to continue ensuring coverage, but finally do a big step on equality and excellence. But we need to ensure, because I sent those, some of those laws to the parliament, and they didn't pass parliament. So it's not only of what you want to do, it's about creating the condition and the political agreement. And that's why it's so important, the popular social movements, because the students in the street were able to create awareness, agreement, and people that will never accept before. I mean, these discussions were not started 2 years ago. Discussions started many years ago. And I said, I sent a lot of these laws, it will not pass. But now, the political conditions were created. So I think now it's a great opportunity in Chile to continue advancing on increasing not only coverage, access, but mainly equality and excellence. And I think that's great news. And finally, I don't understand my writing. Let me see.
I think you addressed them all.
I think so.
I think so.
Otherwise, you write me on the internet.